This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. From the bombing of Pearl Harbor,
President Roosevelt said this is a date that will live in infamy. Today, December the 18th, 2019, is another date that will live in infamy.
To the crucifixion of Jesus.
Pontius Pilate gave Jesus the opportunity to face his accusers. During that sham trial, Pontius Pilate afforded more rights to Jesus than the Democrats have afforded this president.
Lawmakers did not lack for hyperbole during yesterday's marathon impeachment hearing, but the result was what we expected. Donald Trump is now the third president ever to be impeached. The House vote was nearly unanimous along party lines. No Republicans voted for impeachment. This process has gone on for more than a month. We've heard a lot of arguments, talking points from both sides, but which ones hold up? Let's put that to the experts. Here with us in studio is Michael Zeldin, a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics. He's also a former official at the Department of Justice and a legal analyst at CNN. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also in studio is Jeffrey Rosen, the president of the National Constitution Center, a nonprofit that focuses on constitutional education and debate. He is also a professor at the George Washington University School of Law and the author of the new book, Conversations with RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Life, Love, Liberty, and Law. Jeff, it's been always a pleasure to have you with us.
Great to be back.
Had you with us at the beginning of my time and now here near the end to talk about a very big story. But we want to talk to you, too, and we'd love to hear your questions and thoughts about all the arguments we've heard and what all this means. We're taking your calls at 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. Email us 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. First of all, can I just get your immediate reactions to the hearing yesterday, particularly how much of it you actually got through hearing, because it lasted all day and into the night, and then your reactions to the outcome? Michael?
So I listened to it most of the day. I did pause periodically for fear of brain aneurysm, and then I returned back to it, and it went pretty much as I expected it would, which was demagoguery on both sides. If I hear no one is above the law one more time, I think I'll scream. And if I hear that the process was tilted in a preordained, determined way, I think I'll likewise scream. So it met all expectations, as low as they were.
Jeff?
I was distressed by how polarized it was. Impeachment is not supposed to be a purely political act. And the Nixon impeachment gained bipartisan support. The Clinton impeachment was a little more bipartisan than this. There were seven Republicans who crossed the aisle. And that's why I was so interested by Philip Bump's piece in the Washington Post today. He concludes that seven of the votes that crossed lines during the Clinton impeachment came from members of Congress whose ideology is in a moderate zone where no current members of Congress exist. So that was his explanation, that basically the only ability to cross the aisle during the Clinton era was if you were in a moderate zone and needed to keep your votes. And now Congress has become so much more polarized that the members had no wiggle room. And that's too bad for the history of impeachment and for the United States of America.
Jeffrey, last night President Trump talked about this impeachment at a rally in Battle Creek, Michigan that went on for more than 2 hours. Here's just one clip from what the president said last night.
Crazy Nancy Pelosi's House Democrats have branded themselves with an eternal mark of shame, and it really is. It's a disgrace. After 3 years of sinister witch hunts, hoaxes, scams, tonight, the House Democrats are trying to nullify the ballots of tens of millions of patriotic Americans.
That was President Trump speaking last night at a rally in Battle Creek, Michigan. Jeff, we've heard this argument a lot, that the Democrats should just wait for next year's election. This is an attempt to force the president out of office. A number of Republicans made the case that the Democrats are afraid they just can't beat him at the ballot box next year. And so they're going after him now, and they've been constantly going after him. This is just another attempt to prevent themselves from losing an election they know they're going to lose. What do you make of that?
political analysis is not my bailiwick. Others can do it much better. But it strikes me that the Democrats who voted for impeachment did so in spite of the possible political backlash, not because they feared political defeat. It's pretty clear that Democrats believe, in good conscience, that this is the paradigmatic example of a high crime or a misdemeanor, the kind of bribery and corruption that the framers had in mind. And we saw several moderate Democrats from swing districts voting reluctantly for impeachment, even though they understand it might hurt them, because they felt that the Constitution compelled it. So whether they're right or not, I think it's hard to see this from their side as a purely partisan vote. They believe it's a matter of principle. And on the other side, I think we have to give the Republicans the dignity of imagining that they honestly believe that this doesn't meet the standard, which again shows how in an age when facts are contested, you can't even make constitutional judgments that transcend partisanship. And again, that's really deeply distressing.
Some of you have shared some of your thoughts on what this will mean politically. Steve tweeted, "It's not going to be much of a trial. Everyone has already decided how they will vote. I'm afraid all the Democrats did was ensure Trump's re-election." That kind of gets Michael to one of the tweets that the president sent this morning. He wrote, quote, "I got impeached last night without one Republican vote being cast, with the do-nothing Dems on their continuation of the greatest witch hunt in American history. Now the do-nothing party want to do nothing with the articles and not deliver them to the Senate, but it's the Senate's call," unquote. What about that in terms of the Republicans seeming completely in lockstep with him? There were one or two, Will Hurd from Texas among them, who weren't 100% vociferously thundering away at the Democrats over the process.
Right. So we had one independent former Republican who voted with the Democrats. Justin Amash voted yes on both articles of impeachment. No other Republicans voted for the articles of impeachment, not even those who are not running for re-election. So there was an opportunity for people to vote on principle if they had those principles, but they elected not to do so. Maybe it was because they didn't believe in the sanctity of these proceedings, or that they wanted to maintain their political viability in a party that Trump seems to completely dominate in a demagogic-like way. And we'll see how this plays out in the Senate. The president is not correct that it is now up to the Senate. It is still in the House's purview. They have to name managers, those who will essentially prosecute the case in the Senate. Once they name the managers, it goes over to the Senate for the Senate's trial of the matter. But until such time as Nancy Pelosi names those managers, this is in the House.
Ben tweeted, "Why wouldn't the Democrats in the House use the courts to force White House officials such as Bolton, Pompeo, Mulvaney, etc., to testify under oath during the inquiry?" Of course, referring to John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and also some of the people peripheral to them who were on the list of folks that the Democrats had wanted to talk to. Michael, why not go through the courts? Because that's one of the big complaints that the Republicans raised.
Exactly. And I, for one, would have liked to have seen them spend more time in court litigating the what I think are bogus immunity and executive privilege claims that many of these witnesses seem to have been asserting. However, it was a bit of a rope-a-dope situation for them. That is, if they went into the courts, they really could never get out of the courts until the courts reached a final determination. And so they ceded the control of the calendar to the courts if they went that way. And as we've seen in many court cases, these things could take years to litigate. And so they made a decision that they had enough evidence as it was, and they would proceed without the court intervening in most of these cases. Ironically, of course, that the courts that have resolved matters of privilege and immunities have all held against the president. There's not been one decision that has upheld the president's position on this. And so they probably would have won, except for the timeline.
Let's see if we can squeeze in a quick call. 855-236-1A1A. In Atlanta, Scott is on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to know what you guys thought about why the Democrats would not include anything related to emoluments violations in with their articles of impeachment, because, you know, the one thing Republicans have been saying is, you know, there's no proof. There's no proof. And that seems to be the one thing there could be, you know, proof of, at least in, you know, far paper evidence, stuff like that.
Right.
So why do you think the Democrats decided not to do that?
That's a good question. Before I put that to Jeff Scott, what is your suspicion? Why do you think they didn't include it?
I don't know. I think they wanted to be pretty specific on what they brought the articles up on, so they wanted to keep it focused to Ukraine. But I think now, you know, we know how this is going to go down in the Senate trial. Mm-hmm. So if something with emoluments comes up later, the Democrats will look like they are just trying to impeachment, kind of like a whack-a-mole approach.
Right, right. Scott, good question. Jeff, what about that?
It is a great question. And one explanation may have been that the Democrats only wanted things for which there was absolutely clear evidence of a crime. And although the emoluments case is strong, it hasn't been much litigated. It's moving up through the courts. In fact, there are subpoena battles over records relevant to emoluments that the Supreme Court will hear in March and resolve by June. So that may have been one reason. It's the same reason that they may not have included the bribery charge, which, although that's rooted in the text of the Constitution, the case for a violation of the federal statutes on bribery wasn't crystal clear. But the result of all that, although, as you say, Scott, they chose simple articles and put everything together under the broad rubric of abuse of power, they leave themselves open to the claim of Republicans that abuse of power is not a technical criminal violation. You need a technical criminal violation, and therefore, where is it? So the strategic complications were tough. The bottom line is, in the Johnson impeachment, the whole thing foundered over the charge of a technical violation that went down and the broader claim of abuse of power the Democrats decided might have been better in the eyes of history.
I have one more question about the Johnson impeachment when we continue with Jeff Rosen of the National Constitution Center and Michael Zeldin, a legal analyst for CNN. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the impeachment process with legal analyst Michael Zeldin and constitutional expert Jeffrey Rosen. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well about the process, what has happened and what may yet happen. Comment on our Facebook page. Tweet us at 1A. Email 1A at WAMU.org. And the lines are open. We always welcome your calls and voicemails at 855-236-1A1A. We'll get back to our panel in just a bit, but first let's speak to someone who is directly involved in the next phase of this process. Joining us from Capitol Hill is Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Senator Coons, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you, Joshua. Great to be on with you.
What is your take on the way that yesterday turned out? Once the votes were over, you turned off the coverage and you thought to yourself, what?
Oh, well, Joshua, I frankly wasn't watching the coverage because in the Senate we were busy voting. But I thought this is an historic moment. Impeachment now will come over from the House to the Senate. And we have to find a way to deliver for the American people what they deserve, which is not a cover-up, not political theater, but a real and a serious trial. This is only the third time in American history, as I'm sure you've been discussing this morning, that the Senate is exercising its constitutionally appointed role of conducting a trial of a sitting president. And if the conduct of Republican members of the House during the impeachment proceedings there is any predictor, we're in for a rough ride. There will be a fair amount of division and controversy here in the Senate. A number of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle who spoke with me on the floor yesterday during the 13 votes that we were taking all through the afternoon and evening, said that they're concerned, that they want this to be serious, that they want this to be a real and an appropriate trial. But there is deep division about what the process may be, what the rules and witnesses may be, and what the outcome may be.
I'm just going to cut to the question that I hear everybody asking, Senator, because I know it's the question that's in the back of everyone's minds, I think really on both sides of the aisle. And to put it bluntly, the question is, you don't really think Donald Trump is going to get removed as president, do you?
No, I don't. I think all indications are that there is no chance that there are the kinds of votes, the dozens of votes in the Republican caucus that would be needed for him to be removed.
And then what is the point of this?
That has led to a certain fatalism. The whole point of that, I'll remind your listeners, that Speaker Pelosi resisted calls for an impeachment inquiry for months until Donald Trump, in a phone call with the president of Ukraine, did something so brazen that a whistleblower reported it, and that produced the pressure that then created change, both among moderate Democrats in the House and ultimately with Speaker Pelosi, to say, yes, we have to open an impeachment inquiry. And I want to compliment the Intelligence Committee and in particular Chairman Schiff for conducting what was a balanced and an open and an appropriate process where there were many witnesses and many documents reviewed. I didn't expect before that began that there would be so many senior Republicans, major donors to Trump's campaign, career Foreign Service officials who would come forward and confirm all the core elements of the initial concerns that were raised that led to that inquiry. Now that the vote's happened and it's coming over to the Senate, Joshua, you ask a perfectly appropriate question. What's the point if we don't think President Trump will be removed? My concern of mine that follows along that point is, if the president is not convicted in the Senate, he will take that as having been cleared of everything and will then be unbounded, because under the Constitution, the most severe action the Congress can take is impeachment and removal. We may have indicted him in the House through impeachment. We may not be able to remove him in the Senate. And as a result, he may say, I'm free to engage in even more brazen behavior. I'll remind you, it was after the impeachment inquiry was kicked off that he went out on the front lawn of the White House and said, China, if you can go dig up some dirt on my political opponents, please do. I'm paraphrasing. That's not exactly what he said.
Right. But to that point, Senator, I mean, if past is prologue, being slapped on the wrist for doing something wrong does not actually prevent Donald Trump from doing other things. I mean, we've been talking about emoluments in the past. We've talked about, you know, any number of things that he's done in the past that don't seem to have chastened him, but indeed have emboldened him and his political base. So I think it's worth, you know, weighing whether or not impeachment not only feels like a slap on the wrist, but also a smack on the backside to get back in the game and fight even harder.
Well, Joshua, one thing that happened yesterday that was striking that I think confirms that view on your part is I received the president's Christmas card, and it does say Merry Christmas in very large, very bold red letters. But included along with it on beautiful White House stationery with a big embossed gold seal was a long letter. It was a 6-page letter that was addressed to Speaker Pelosi, but apparently distributed to every member of Congress. That is the first I've seen of a sort of formal defense by President Trump. It is a wild ride. It careens from point to point. It denounces Congress. It denounces Speaker Pelosi. It attacks the entire impeachment process. It talks about his great accomplishments. It talks about the ways in which he's the greatest president that's ever lived. And then in conclusion, it talks about history and how President Trump hopes that this letter will be read over the decades, such that a century from now, another greatest president of all time won't face a similar dishonorable impeachment. His response to impeachment is to become more and more agitated and more engaged in completely unconventional responses. I had, perhaps without foundation, hoped that when the trial came to the Senate, President Trump would behave like previous presidents and send over a seasoned legal team of, you know, White House counsel and some outside attorneys, mm-hmm. and that they would mount a sort of normal challenge, a response. He would present some witnesses or some documents that he believes would clear him of these charges. Given the letter I received yesterday, I don't think he'll do anything like that. I think he'll simply attack the process, and I am concerned that his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, has just returned from Ukraine on another fishing expedition to gin up more ungrounded dirt on his political opponents, and I suspect President Trump will unleash Rudy Giuliani to spend all of his time in the next couple of weeks with a well-funded social media campaign to serve as his de facto response, attacking the entire legitimacy of Congress and our constitutional role.
Since you mentioned the letter, I should read just the last little piece of that letter, which has been widely published. It ends with, quote, "There is far too much that needs to be done to improve the lives of our citizens. It is time for you and the highly partisan Democrats in Congress to immediately cease this impeachment fantasy and get back to work for the American people. While I have no expectation that you will do so, I write this letter to you for the purpose of history and to put my thoughts on a permanent and indelible record. 100 years from now, when people look back at this affair, I want them to understand it and learn from it so that it can never happen to another president again." Unquote. That's the end of the letter that President Trump sent to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We are speaking to Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. We'll get to some more of your questions in just a moment, but Senator, I should note that Speaker Mitch McConnell and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer are speaking on the Senate floor as we speak, and here is a quick clip of what Senator McConnell has just said. I'd like to get your reaction to it. Listen.
This week wasn't even the first time House Democrats have introduced articles of impeachment. It was actually the seventh time. They started less than 6 months after the president was sworn in. They tried to impeach President Trump for being impolite to the press, for being mean to professional athletes, for changing President Obama's policy on transgender people in the military. All of these things were high crimes and misdemeanors, according to Democrats.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on the floor of the Senate this morning. It is worth noting, just to Senator McConnell's point, that if you want to get super technical about it, if you read the articles of impeachment against Andrew Johnson, Article 10 does actually involve him being rude. And it accuses him of, quote, bringing the high office of the President of the United States into contempt, ridicule, and disgrace to the great scandal of all good citizens, unquote. So there is a legal precedent for attempting to impeach a president for being a jerk, just to put it simply. But Senator Coons, what do you make of Mitch McConnell's comment that the Democrats are just banging the same drum they have banged since January 20th, 2017, and it didn't work then, and it ain't going to work now?
Two things, Joshua. First, Majority Leader McConnell is making a wildly overbroad statement as if all Democrats began trying to impeach President Trump from day one. He is, of course, correct that there are a few Democrats who introduced articles of impeachment months and years ago. But in a large and raucous and diffuse body of 435 members of the House of Representatives, you could end virtually any sentence with "was introduced in the House." There are bills doing hundreds of different things. My hunch is, I don't know this, but it's worth researching. My hunch is that in previous Congresses, there have been articles of impeachment introduced with some regularity. The real point here is that Speaker Pelosi, the leader of the Democratic caucus and the leader of the House, did not embrace or endorse any of those impeachment efforts over the months and years that President Trump has been president until the whistleblower revealed a pattern of conduct with regards to Ukraine that put at risk our next election. It was only then that dozens and dozens of members of the House in the Democratic caucus came forward and said, this behavior is so corrosive to our democracy, so fundamental to what we expect from a president, that we have to open an impeachment inquiry. So Mitch McConnell on the floor, the majority leader of the Senate, is suggesting that Democrats have been wildly flailing around trying to find some excuse to impeach the president since he was elected. That might be true of a few members of the House. I don't know. It is certainly not true of Speaker Pelosi, who steadfastly resisted calls from both inside her caucus and the general public to try to impeach President Trump for a range of things he did that were demonstrably inappropriate, as the results of the Mueller investigation revealed, as the results of a lawsuit against the president around emoluments and his failure to distance himself from the economic interests of his family business would suggest. Mm-hmm. So I would strongly disagree with Majority Leader McConnell. I think it was only when it became clear President Trump was alleged to be engaging in a pattern of conduct that put our next election at risk that she took this unprecedented step in this Congress of saying, now we must have an impeachment inquiry.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Senator, let me put a few quick questions from our audience to you in the time we have left. Anne asks, if the House withholds articles of impeachment from the Senate, what does that mean and why would it change anything that happens in the Senate? Anne is, of course, referring to Speaker Pelosi not yet sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate, presumably to kind of wait a little bit to see what the groundwork is going to be laid for the trial and under what circumstances those articles will be dealt with. Senator, what would you say to Anne?
Well, I'd say this, you know, Speaker Pelosi will inevitably transfer those articles to the Senate, and there will be a trial. The timing here also just happens to be that this week we are taking up and passing several significant bills. I think the USMCA, the new trade deal with Canada and Mexico, will be voted out of the House today or tomorrow, and the appropriations bills are being taken up by the Senate today. Once those big pieces of legislative work are finished by tomorrow, the House and Senate will be in recess over the holiday period. So there's no point in her sending us the impeachment articles until we return from that break. And she has legitimate concerns that Majority Leader McConnell, at least as of last night, hadn't even met with Minority Leader Schumer to discuss what the rules will be around documents, around evidence to ensure there's a fair trial.
Bud writes, the House of Representatives fulfilled its constitutional obligation. It is now the president and senators who are on trial. While the senators are neither prosecutors or judges, their judgment will be under scrutiny. Senator?
I agree, and that's why it's important that all senators take seriously the oath that we will take at the beginning of the trial to do impartial justice. We have a wide range of senators saying they've already reached a conclusion, and I don't think that's appropriate. We need to emphasize that we will keep an open mind. Speaking for myself, I did not see evidence or hear evidence in the House proceedings, to the extent I was able to follow them and read regular summaries, that exonerated or that cleared the president, largely because President Trump stonewalled requests for testimony and documents. If he has a defense to make, now is the time to make it. I'll remind you, the second article on which he was impeached last night is obstruction of Congress. That's a reference to the fact that he just refused, unlike President Clinton, unlike President Nixon, who directed their senior cabinet officials and closest advisors to respond to congressional subpoenas and to testify and cooperate with the impeachment inquiries. In this case, I think President Trump is the first president in history to refuse to cooperate with an impeachment inquiry. So I think it is coherent for me to say I'm keeping an open mind. But so far, I have heard and seen very little evidence to support the president's assertion that he did nothing wrong.
Senator, briefly, before I let you go, I'd love to just get a sense of where your head is at, where your heart is at. You're about to be in the middle of a historic moment in a trial that you have said you believe is not going to end with the removal of the president. How does this just strike you as an American?
Joshua, it grieves me. I am concerned that one of the core pieces of our founders' vision, the way they structured our government, was to have us not be a parliamentary system, where our national leader, the prime minister, could be subject to a motion of no confidence at any moment. But they also wanted to make sure we didn't have a monarch, someone who was elected and then for 4 years could not be reined in at all, no matter how inappropriate or wild or against national interest their actions would be. So they gave us this mechanism of impeachment, and they trusted that members of the Senate and the House would put the national interest above any partisan or personal or political interest.
Right, right.
I'm concerned we don't have a moment here where we've got a disciplined group of senators willing to look at the evidence and put the interests of our country and history first rather than play partisan politics.
Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Senator Coons, we really appreciate your time. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Lots more questions when we continue. We'll bring Michael Zeldin and Jeff Rosen back in. We want to lean real hard on your questions about the process. Plenty of you on the phones. If you want to send in a few more questions or thoughts, you've still got a little bit more time. 1A@WAMU.org. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with legal analyst Michael Zeldin and constitutional expert Jeffrey Rosen. Plenty of good questions I want to get to, but we were just talking during the break, and I'd love to hear you both answer about the fact that there were so many speeches yesterday, and there have been so many speeches through this whole process, and we know everyone's listened to all of them. But if the people who have totally tuned out wanted to go back and listen to, like, one, maybe two speeches that would kind of typify this, that really hit a nail on the head, who would you suggest they listen to? If they only want to go back and say, look, I just want to hear one or two. Jeff?
Well, I thought Speaker Pelosi's beginning of the proceedings with the Pledge of Allegiance was a patriotic note that reminded everyone of the need to consider the questions in constitutional rather than political terms. And I thought it was great.
Michael?
So I thought the very end where Steny Hoyer gave a presentation as to why this is constitutionally imperative, and it is not a matter of politics, but a matter of constitutional importance. If you wanted to hear the counter argument, Kevin McCarthy probably was the most full-throated defender of the president, mostly not on the merits of the accusations, but rather the truncated process that they felt inhibited the president's rights.
Yeah, Kevin McCarthy was the last Republican to speak. He kind of used the remainder of the Republicans' debate time to wrap it all up. Here is a clip of his closing argument.
In the past, in this body, such a step demanded a vote from all of us from the start. But not only did she move to impeach before she gave this House and the hundreds of millions of people we represent a say in whether to pursue an impeachment inquiry, she threw out the bipartisan standards this House gave President Nixon and Clinton. That is why I immediately sent Speaker Pelosi a letter asking her to follow the rules of history, of tradition, and follow those standards that have served America well.
That was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy speaking at the end of the debate on the Articles of Impeachment, just before Democrat Adam Schiff spoke and then the votes. All right, let's get to your questions and thoughts. I want to move kind of briskly from here on out. Of course, we'll continue discussing this tomorrow on the Friday News Roundup. But let's get back to the phones now. In Durham, North Carolina, Scott is on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning, and I just want to say how much we're going to miss you, Joshua.
Oh, thank you.
I look forward to seeing you in your new place. But my question is one that really wasn't raised during the hearings, but it's a basic issue about financial accountability. We have the president's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, going to Ukraine on multiple visits. How is he getting paid? Is he getting paid personally from the president, or is that out of a slush fund or the taxpayer expense? I mean, that's a reasonable question to ask, is how are the people involved in this getting paid? And the accountability goes to both time and finances, basic things, plane flights, food, hotel bills. Where is that money coming from that's paying all these people involved in this to undertake this this scheme in Ukraine? It never really came up in any of the hearings, and maybe this is part of the additional avenues of investigation that needs to be pursued, but it's kind of a basic one. If that's taxpayer money, then that needs to be accounted for.
Well,
when you have the Ambassador Sondland, who, you know, we understand he contributed a large amount of money, and he gets rewarded with an ambassadorship, but he's going and being paid at taxpayer expense to do this, and I almost heard him say something along the lines, well, this is just what the president wanted.
Right.
This idea of just following orders is something that I think we all have a knee-jerk reaction to, saying that's not good enough.
Well, Scott, that's a good question. I do want to put that to Michael. I hate to cut you short. I just want to make sure we get as many questions as possible. Michael, that's a good question, I think, particularly because the follow the money piece of this, I think, was one of the first lines of inquiry that a lot of Democrats went into. But when you're dealing with Rudy Giuliani and Gordon Sondland and all these different players, it feels like it could quickly get muddy from an investigative standpoint, and thus it could make for a muddy case to the American people. But how do you see it?
Well, so to answer his direct question is, we don't know the answers to those questions. We know that Giuliani has said that he is providing his services to the president for free. That is, he is not billing him on an hourly basis for his legal time. What we do not know is how the related expenses, travel and the other things that the caller mentioned, are being reimbursed. And they could be campaign contributions if they're being paid by third parties that need to be reported to the Federal Election Commission. They could be reimbursements that the campaign 2020 or the campaign 2016 is allowed to make him if it's related to drives from the past election. But we do not know the answer to that. And it is a very muddied picture, Joshua, as you say, in terms of presenting it to the American people as a high crime and misdemeanor. So I think it's properly left out of this discussion, but it's worthy of consideration down the line.
Jeffrey, maybe you can get a question from Sacco, who tweeted, "The GOP argument of no due process rights confuses me. Isn't due process only extended once someone has been indicted for a crime? Is this somehow different in an impeachment trial?"
Yes, it is different in an impeachment trial. The Constitution says that the House has sole power of impeachment. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Walter Nixon case in 1993 said that the Supreme Court has no role to play in second-guessing any processes granted or not granted by the House or the Senate in its sole sovereignty over the Senate trial. There were some concurring opinions in the Nixon case saying maybe if the House or Senate just flipped a coin rather than holding a real hearing, that might be different. But the unanimous holding of the court is essentially that the process due is whatever the House says it is. And therefore, you can complain that more process should have been due and it wasn't fair and so forth. But there's no constitutional or legal right to it.
Julie is listening from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Hey, Julie, what's on your mind?
Hi, Joshua. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to kind of make a comment here that I feel that a lot of the GOP speeches yesterday touched upon the fact that the bribery was unsuccessful. And I just want to point out that if you attempt to rob a bank, you still go to jail for attempted robbery, whether or not you had cash that you removed from the bank. And the same applies in the concept of bribery. If you attempt bribery, whether you are successful or not, you have still made the attempt, and that is the illegal component. And I feel that there is just too much emphasis placed on the wrong syllable here, and we are getting away from the point that this president is brazen in everything that he does. And if you want to avoid talking about the fact that his hotel rooms at Mar-a-Lago are a lot more expensive during certain, you know, political junket times. Or if you want to avoid the fact that he is, you know, embezzling or taking away from charities that he has a name to.
Right.
The fact is he attempted to bribe. That is the problem. And to allow him to continue to do as he feels fit is the inappropriate component that the House is seeking to impeach here.
Julie, let me put your point to Michael Zeldin, particularly, Michael, because bribery is named by name in the Constitution as an impeachable offense. Treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors.
Right. And so in this case, the allegation in Article 1 is that he abused his power, and he did so by soliciting the president of Ukraine to open up an investigation of his political rival. That's the primary obligation that informs the first article. Secondary to that is this notion of, in addition to the illicit solicitation, he exacted this quid pro quo, this for that, unless you do this investigation, I will not release money. That's what the caller is referring to as the bribery part of it. And she's correct to say that the crime of bribery is committed when the person solicits the bribe, irrespective of whether the bribe is actually received in return. So it's not even really attempted bribery. It is bribery. To solicit a payment under those circumstances is a bribe. But I think more important to the allegation in Article 1 is the act of the solicitation of President Zelensky of Ukraine twice in that narrative that was described as a transcript between the president and Zelensky to open up an investigation into the Bidens.
But Jeffrey, why not go for bribery directly? I mean, the phrase quid pro quo kept coming up during these hearings. quid pro quo is inherent to the definition of what bribery is. So it seems like the Democrats could have made a case that, like, Donald Trump committed an impeachable offense that is listed verbatim in the Constitution.
As a constitutional textualist, I hope that they would, because it would be, have been something that the Johnson impeachment shied away from. And as you say, there's a very powerful case, it's been made by lots of scholars, that although there was no federal bribery statute at the time of the framing, the framers conceived of bribery both as the offering as well as the receipt of a bribe, and they were especially concerned about the offering of favors to foreign powers in response for private rather than public, private gain rather than the public good. Why didn't the Democrats do it? I haven't seen them describe it at length. I gather from the testimony of the scholars at the House hearings was that they weren't convinced that it met the technical definition of a bribe under federal law, and they wanted only to charge things that were technical violations of crimes. Whether or not that was a good idea politically, it was unfortunate constitutionally.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Before I come to you, Michael, Jeff, is it possible the Democrats just chickened out?
I mean, chickened out from what I guess, but chickened out from not being able to say, hey, we Democrats have the right to interpret the Constitution on our own. We don't have to rely on the courts or what federal have said about technical statutes. Our solemn responsibility is to define bribery, and it is listed as a constitutional offense. So in that sense, yes, they may have
Michael?
Chickened out.
Well, I think that Jeffrey is largely right here, but I think that the ultimate determination of what the members of Congress had in mind was that they did not want to engage in a conversation with Republicans on the Senate floor about whether 18 United States Code 1505, the bribery statute, was met, because that really falls into a bad trap for the Democrats. They want to be able to say that the conduct, generally speaking, was an abuse of power, irrespective of whether you call it a bribery offense or an attempted bribery offense or an extortion offense. They just didn't want to get involved in a discussion about statutory law. They wanted to talk about the broader principles of the conduct.
Michael, we touched on this a bit, but Dan tweeted, if Trump was innocent, why not call witnesses to exonerate? Why hasn't this been driven home? The argument carries the day for me. Michael?
Well, no one under our criminal justice system, of course, has an obligation to prove themselves innocent. It's the prosecutor who has the obligation to prove themselves guilty. Now, this is an impeachment. It's a different matter than a criminal case. But the president is under no obligation legally to prove his innocence. I thought that the president, if in fact there are extenuating circumstances, if this call with Zelensky was in fact perfect and there are witnesses who can attest to that, then it would have behooved the president to bring those witnesses or allow those witnesses to come forward. Remember why we have the article of impeachment number 2, obstruction of Congress, is because the president has flat out prevented anyone with any information, exculpatory or not, from testifying. And that is sort of abusive to the system of checks and balances that the constitutional framers put in place.
Just to clarify something you said earlier, Jeffrey, Janice writes, I thought I heard Jeffrey Rosen make a comment that could be interpreted to mean you need an underlying statutory crime in order to impeach a president. I thought that was not the case. Could you please clarify?
That's correct. It is not the case. And I hope I didn't say that. And if I did, let me clarify that I don't believe it. You do not need an underlying crime to impeach. And the framers clearly believed that not every criminal offense was impeachable and not every impeachable offense was criminal, as we've heard many times. So for that reason, the Democrats could have impeached over bribery, even if it wasn't a technical crime.
So where do we go from here? Michael, what's the next step? What should we be keeping an eye out for?
Well, there are two things, I think. First is the historical perspective that Senator McConnell wants us to think about. And I think that we have to understand that in the Clinton impeachment, for example, Tom DeLay and Henry Hyde, who were leaders of this, referred to this campaign against Clinton as the campaign, as if it was a Civil War battle. They were fully partisan in their approach to this thing. Second is, how does the Senate address the issues of witnesses? Because if they just rely on the House depositions and do not call witnesses who have matters to elucidate what happened, I think they make a mistake. for history, for the country, and for themselves.
Jeffrey, you were our first guest on this program. You are now one of our last guests on this program. It's amazing, just in the last few seconds we have, how the Constitution and the nature of how this government works has been like the story of the Trump administration in so many ways.
It has, and it's been such a meaningful series of conversations with you, Joshua, and thank you for convening citizens from around the country to discuss issues ranging from the First Amendment, which we began by discussing, to impeachment. And if there's any silver lining in all of this debate, it is that it's the basic duty of citizenship for all of us to read the Constitution, to debate it, and to make up our own mind. And that's what your listeners have done so well, and it's been an honor to be part of it.
Of course, the program is going on. I'm just walking away, but we will be back.
This may be my last chance.
Right,
so
but Jeffrey Rosen, the president of the National Constitution Center. If the only thing you do on a trip to Philadelphia is go to the National Constitution Center, it will be a trip worth taking. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And Michael Zeldin, legal analyst at CNN and a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Paige Osborne. You can learn more about our team at the1a.org. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow for my very last Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.